My guest today is Dr. Jeffrey Martineau. I'm going to call him Jeff because he's a friend of mine. He's the founder of Higher Education Partners, which is a consulting group that works with schools, colleges, and universities around the world to strengthen their humanities and liberal arts curriculum. He also works with K through 12 to do the same thing. And the reason he does that is because for 8 years, he worked with the American Academy for Liberal Education, which is the only recognized international accreditor that is recognized by the U.S. Department of Education. He served for many years as its president and went around the world to more than 20 countries as well as state and private universities in the U.S., handling their accreditation, which, by the way, included a great many Catholic schools. He has a doctorate in constitutional law, political philosophy from the Claremont Graduate University, and that's what we're going to talk about. He's taught political philosophy at places like Georgetown, Princeton, Claremont McKinnon, you know, small institutions, unimpressive institutions like that. Jeff, welcome to Church and Culture.
Well, thank you, Dale. Happy to be here.
Now, we're going to tackle for our listeners today what I consider one of the most important issues of modernity of the present day, and one of the most confusing and most, I would say, controversial, and that's the subject of human rights. And let me explain to you, doesn't need an explanation, and to the listening audience why I want to talk about human rights. I want to talk about human rights is because every time I turn around, I'm being told that somebody has a right to something and that the federal government should give it to them, that the federal government should supply whatever it is that people have a right to. And then all of a sudden I'm confused, because then I go back to our own Declaration of Independence, which is probably the best known of all statements on human rights, which of course was, it passed our Congress on July 4, 1776, where it says about human rights, it says this: we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, before I throw it to you, Jeff, I just want to point out a few things from that well-known sentence. First of all, these rights are unalienable. That means they are not something that the state bestows upon us. It's something that we have by our nature and cannot be taken away. But, and that there are more than just life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, at least according to this document written mostly by Thomas Jefferson. But when I look at life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, I don't think them as things that can be supplied by the state. They don't fit that description. They fit another narrative, another description. In other words, if you say someone has the right to the pursuit of happiness, it's not to say that the state or any other individual or institution is obligated to give them happiness. I mean, after all, we all know by common sense that happiness isn't the kind of thing that can be given to anybody. It has to be, as it were, earned, or it has to be grasped in some way. So Jeff, here's the big question I want us to discuss. How did we get from this understanding of rights, as we find in our own Declaration of Independence, to this, the way the word rights or human rights are used right now, when some politician says that people should be given something because they have a right to it? How did that disparity develop?
Well, you're very right, Deal, to point to the Declaration as kind of the touchstone for what human rights ought to be. I think that what has happened is that over the course of a long period of time, say over 150 years, our idea, our notion of what a right means has changed. Generally speaking, we no longer collectively look to the Declaration what we come to think of is that whatever we need can be either given or taken away by government. And just as you've indicated, you know, groups will go to the powers that be, whether it be courts or politics, to try to achieve their ends in that way and say, this is a right and I'm owed this right and everyone else owes me this right. And that it is only with this right that will allow me to be happy. I think you have to go back to the middle of the 19th century, around the time of our Civil War, when coming out of Europe, there were ideas of something called the state. and the state became a pseudonym for the person. In other words, it meant that people are not either smart enough or we don't care enough about our fellow man, and that we can't possibly know what is truly correct and what is really right. And so therefore, those that can know those things, certain intellectual elites, certain bodies that become created, we think of them as bureaucracies now. You know, in the United States, we had something called the progressive movement that starts, you know, after the Civil War. And for progressive, this is exactly what they meant, that the state becomes something of a surrogate for the people. In other words, that we can't possibly, between our families, our work, our self-interest, we can't possibly know what we ought to do for others. And so, therefore, that burden is going to be taken away from us, and we're going to give it to, say, a bureaucracy, and allow them to solve these problems for us through the issuing of rights. And, of course, I think the fundamental problem with it is it does two things. It obligates everyone else to another person for that right. It also makes our rights very tenuous, because it's the idea that rights don't come from nature or nature's God, as the Declaration puts it. They come from people. You can call it the state, you can call it government. It's still coming from people. But over time, you know, people's knowledge and views can change. And if we're going to say rights come from the people, then that means rights will change over time.
Well, let me ask you to clarify one thing. I'm talking with Dr. Jeff Martineau, who's a political philosopher, about the issue of how did the kind of unalienable rights that we read about in our Declaration from 200 years ago, over 200 years ago, have become, as it were, demands that things be delivered to us from the government. And he's saying, well, first of all, approximately 100 years after the Declaration was written, this notion of the state came into our country from European intellectual sources, which basically moved the focus of attention about the importance of rights from the individual, whatever the individual might or might not do, to what the state could do and should do vis-a-vis individual citizens. Is that about right, Jeff?
Yes. And really, in the modern context, we've come to think of that movement as being coming from what we call the political left, for the most part.
Well, first of all, what were the European sources that you're talking about, and sort of how did they get in our bloodstream?
Well, I think that there's a number, and I don't want to bore people with it. You know, if you go back to the late 1700s, the end of the 18th century, you have thinkers such as Rousseau and Kant. And then from that, you have the significant German thinkers, all the students of Friedrich Hegel in the early 1800s. And probably the two students we most know of now would be Marx and Nietzsche. And Marx and Nietzsche, one essentially went to the left in Marx, and one went to the right in Nietzsche. And I think what's important for us to think about with those thinkers is that they came up with an idea not only of the state, but something called the will, W-I-L-L. In other words, what became important was whether or not someone, an individual or a group of individuals, could in fact achieve what they want to achieve. In other words, that they have the resource, the power, essentially, to craft society and make it into a certain, to make it into what they wanted it to be. That's quite a bit different than the American founding. The American founding is not based on the will of the individual. For the German thinkers and the modern thinkers, it very much is, what's my vision? And what's my will? And can I drive that will to some kind of completion? We can certainly see that in politics in America today.
So in other words, the and you say this came into the United States politics after the Civil War, in what was called the progressive movement. I mean, for the layperson, is it enough to say that it was seen in those politicians who more and more looked to the federal government to solve human problems all the way down to the individual level?
Oh, certainly. I mean, kind of the father in America of the progressive movement is a former president, Woodrow Wilson.
And okay, now that was later than mid-century, 19th century.
Well, it is, but he gets his PhD in the 1870s. So that's just a little bit after our Civil War. He's one of the first Americans to go abroad and earn what by then was become called a doctorate.
Where did he go?
You're asking me a question. What's in my head? But
I'll get it. Go ahead. You keep talking.
He studied in Germany. He came back in the 1870s. He then became a political scientist, one of the first political scientists. And he was writing books in the 1880s. And in those, he writes a book about American government. And in it, he's very critical of American government, about the Declaration of Independence, and of our Constitution. And what he writes is that the Constitution and the Declaration were essentially good for those people then, 100 years before. But we now know things. We have progressed. We are smarter. We know science has proven certain things to us now that they couldn't have known 100 years ago. So therefore, these documents are no longer relative to us. And so the Constitution now needs to become organic. It needs to adapt over time as people and societies change. And as we come to know more, we have to have a document that allows that.
Well, now was ultimately the UN Charter of Human Rights the document that sort of codified this new attitude toward human rights?
I think to some extent it is. Certainly in the UN Charter, in some of the latter articles, when it talks about, when it tries to define human rights.
By the way, which was a second try at Woodrow Wilson's League of Nations, which failed after the First World War.
Yes. There's no doubt that the UN Charter has a much more expansive view of human rights. Now let's keep in mind, for the audience, we're talking about two slightly different things here. For the American founding and the Declaration, we're talking about something called natural right. They would not have defined it as human rights. They called it natural right. And what they meant by that is that there are certain things in us that are there from inception. You could say it's put there by God. You could say it's put there by nature. In a certain sense, you don't have to be a Christian to believe that. And then we are given a reason. Our reason can allow us to discern those certain natural aspects that are in every human being, regardless of their station. When we get to a later period, the UN Charters, the 1940s, we now have a different view. We have a different conception of politics. Politics is what the state will bestow or take away or grant or forbid. It's no longer about really the interaction among people. It's no longer about what is natural. By the time you get to the 20th century, you've had the influence of particularly of Marxist thought. And that Marxist thought really is the idea that the state needs to be the chief, kind of the point of the spear, that if you wish to have change, It needs to come through the state. That to have it go through the people, gosh knows what will happen. You know, people are not, as I've already said, they're not smart enough. They don't know all the things they ought to know. But some of us elites, we do know these things. And so therefore, we're going to make sure that those things happen. You can think of it, for example, there's a book that has just come out by a former Supreme Court Justice, John Paul Stevens. And in it, and this is somebody who was on the court for over 30 years, a noted liberal, and in it, he talks about the democratic process. And he says that essentially the democratic process isn't really enough. And so therefore we need to have a whole slew of new amendments to prevent certain things from happening. And so it's very interesting that this movement on rights, the idea becomes that once a right is given or a political decision is made, that's it. The debate discussion ceases.
Once it's enshrined as a right.
Yes. Then the discussion is supposed to stop and cease. This is no longer a topic for debate.
And is this because at some point, legally, politically, and culturally, when you call something a right, nobody thought they could challenge it? Is that it?
Well, I think there's something to that deal, but I think that what it really means is that for some, they want to use the political process to get to the point where they want to get to. Whatever that right is. But once that right has been achieved, the political process ceases. Well, if you think about that in a democracy, we would not normally think of that within a democracy. We would understand that maybe over time, if through debate and discussion, we may come to think about things differently. For some, once these very much individual rights are bestowed and we now all have an obligation towards them, they want to cut off the discussion, and now we'll move to the next right. And once we've gotten that, we stop discussing that and so forth.
So we have then the veritable unchallengeability, for lack of another word, of the word right as a consequence of the focus on the meaning of rights moving from what the individual has the privilege or opportunity to attain, such as happiness, to what the state should provide to all its citizens because the state knows best about what human flourishing ought to be.
Exactly. And keep in mind that it's a double-edged sword because the founders of America had a certain view of human nature, and that view was codified in the Declaration and in the Constitution.
And that's the view we no longer have, am I right?
That is generally the view we no longer have, and that view was the following. Man was neither despicable nor was he an angel. He was capable of greatness and goodness, but he was also, as history told us, he was also capable of depravity. But man is not one or the other. He is capable of both good and bad.
Which is why we need a balance of powers.
Exactly. So you look at the Constitution in fact reflects that mixed view of human nature. But if you get to the modern notion of rights, that's a different view of human nature. That view of human nature really is solely negative. In other words, you know, it's an assumption that man is always going to be self-interested and he's always only going to do what he wants and he will not care about his fellow neighbor. And because of that, we cannot entrust certain things to man. We need to take away those things from man lest others, you know, have their property or their happiness. They can't achieve that. It's two very different views of human nature, deal, and that becomes reflected in politics. And I think that if you look at, we have a president now, and you look at some of how he couches certain things, it tends to be very negative. Another very much on the idea that we have large segments of society that are not being looked after. In other words, the rest of society has done a very poor job of looking after its fellow man. And so, therefore, we're going to continue to put things in place at the state level to try to rectify that. Well, that's a very different view of human nature. There's nothing positive there except for those that have come to have the historical knowledge.
Let me interrupt and ask you this question. We know that the principles embodied in our founding documents are to be the principles, the legal standards by which our country is led politically, and the way in which courts determine, especially the Supreme Court, determine their judgments on cases that come before this. Is that a correct assumption?
It would have been at one.
No, wait, don't say, don't qualify it. I'm about to ask you the other side. Is it even possible to do that if the view of human nature that is implicit in those documents is no longer held today?
Yeah, I think it's a very good question, Deal. And I think there's a general assumption that the Declaration is not a document that can be looked at anymore. And some would even say that the Constitution only in certain ways can be. And I'll give you an example. If you look at the current nine justices on the court, there's really only one that really very consistently says, look, we need to start with the Declaration and then the Constitution. And that would be Clarence Thomas, no doubt somebody that you've probably talked about on your program before.
Right.
He is very clear in saying that, look, this is a document. This is the touchstone. If we are to understand the American political system as it was designed, not necessarily as it's practiced today, but as it was designed, we cannot leave out the Declaration of Independence. It's not a legal document in the way that the Constitution is, but it tells us things about humans that we need to take into account. And there's no question that for at least 100 years after the Declaration of Independence, certainly through Abraham Lincoln and a bit after that, and certainly through Grant as president, that was the view. I mean, Lincoln talks at length over the years about the centrality of the Declaration of Independence. Well, we don't find that anymore. That's not our touchstone anymore.
Would it be accurate to say in a kind of broad way that documents like the 1948 UN Declaration of Human Rights is more the kind of touchstone we go by?
I think to some extent, yes. I mean, you even see it on the U.S. Supreme Court. I mean, over the years, different justices have wanted to bring that document in as a way to justify their opinions. And it's kind of interesting because that's not an American document for an American court. It's a document that's supposed to somehow apply in another context around the world. I think there is some truth in that. And now, to some extent, one can understand that. If you look at the 20th century, again, probably something you've talked about quite a bit, you know, the 20th century was a deadly century. You
look the deadliest of all, as Paul Johnson showed.
Exactly. And you think about, you know, everything that happened from the beginning to the end of the 20th century. To some extent, one could understand then having some of these views. They see people and governments doing awful things, certainly on Christian things. And so therefore, you might be inclined to say, well, we ought to have certain kinds of things in government where we're trying to take away these decision-making powers so that people's passions don't get in the way. So one could understand that. But the problem in practice is it doesn't really work that way. What we're doing is we have now put ourselves in a situation. If you think about our presidential elections, and you think about what we look for, we look at, well, what is this person talking about? What is their, quote, vision? And we then often vote based on this notion of what is this individual's vision for us.
Yeah, by the way, whenever I hear that word, I run for the forest.
Well,
I don't want to hide.
Well, you ought to, and I can tell you exactly where that came from. That came from Woodrow Wilson, and it came from his chapter in his book in the middle of the 1880s on the president. And it's it, and I, when I've taught courses on American government, I assign that book. And it's very clear. Here is somebody in the 1880s talking about 21st century presidential elections, because what he articulates is exactly what has happened, that the idea of the will, if I win, I have now convinced people I am, quote, the leader. I am now going to set the course. I need to have that vision. It is my will, and they may not use that word, but that's really what they're trying to articulate. They're trying to say, I have the will to push us in this direction. That's a very different view than America was founded on. It was not founded on the idea of the strong individual. That very much comes out of European political philosophy in the middle of the 1800s. And we have largely adopted that, and we've bought into it.
I'm talking with Dr. Jeff Martineau, expert on all things political and philosophical, who has spent much of his career helping colleges, universities, graduate schools, even elementary, junior high, and high schools, strengthen their liberal arts and humanities program. And you can hear from our discussion, he can very well represent what the Founding Fathers wanted this country to be guided by. We'll be back with Jeff Martineau right after this break. Please come back and listen to us. I'm back with Dr. Jeff Martineau. We're talking about this notion of what a right is, what a human right is, what a natural right is, whether or not it's something that comes from the fact that we are created by God, that we have a nature, a fixed nature that cannot be changed, cannot be declared to be different by the government or anyone else for that matter, and that this notion of right that is read in our own founding documents is no longer the notion of rights that is being used politically, either at the level of legislation or of popular understanding or even of sort of philanthropic public policy understanding. In other words, we've gone from, if I may try to sort of really condense it, from the notion of a human right, which, by the way, Jeff, you rightly said would have been called a natural right 200 years ago. So we've gone from a natural right, which is a privilege or an opportunity to pursue something which everyone else has a duty to get out of the way of your pursuit. They have a duty to not be an obstacle to your pursuit of it. So it's as if a natural right is a door that is open and has to remain open, and everyone has a duty to keep it open, but it's up to you to go through it. Okay, we've gone from that notion of right to the notion of rights as entitlements, but entitlements that are bestowed upon people as entitlements by the overarching, all-knowing, omniscient state, as it has been enshrined in progressive thinking since, as you said, post-Civil War period. Is that a good summation?
I think it is, Gil, yeah.
Well, those are like two completely different things. And so here we have in public discussion, you know, our kids go to, you know, to school and learn about the Declaration of Independence. And they walk outside and listen to the radio or NPR or watch TV, and they hear the word right or human right, and they think, do you blame them for being confused?
Well, you know, I think the challenge is, as you rightly point, education. And if you look at the Declaration, you look at those three words, life, liberty, and happiness. And I think what we've done, essentially, is we've taken a very different view of what happiness is. Happiness becomes whatever I want, whether I can achieve it or not. That's what will make me happy. And I just give an example. There was the mass murderer, Ted Bundy, who killed, I think it was 88, 89 young women back in the 70s and 80s. You know, right before he died, he was interviewed by Dr. James Dobson. And he said, Dr. Dobson asked him, why did you do this? What happened to you? He said, well, I learned philosophy.
Oh, God.
And modern philosophy told me that I need to do what made me happy.
Did he really say that?
Oh, absolutely. He said, and really, at the time, I believed I had the power to do this. I had the power over these people. I could do what I wanted. There wasn't something there to prevent it. And that modern philosophy told me what was important, what could I achieve, and did it make me happy? Well, I don't want to say too much about that and how we view happiness now, but, we've gone pretty far down that road that whatever makes me happy ought to be allowable. There have been a number of essays written in the last few weeks about, people in relationships with animals and saying that, now that's going to be the next right because it makes me happy, or underage children.
Now, wait a minute. What kind of relationship with animals is going to be declared a right?
Physical.
Oh, come on. Come on. You're kidding,
okay,
right?
You already see articles, but there were a couple out of the UK about people marrying their dogs.
So I guess Rick Santorum wasn't so far off when he made that now historical comment about the Texas
exactly.
Supreme Court finding on homosexual sex acts.
Exactly. And again, of course, keep in mind that the court typically follows behind politics. It does occasionally get out in front of politics. But my point is that once you've said that certain things are allowable and you've detached it from nature, remember, one of the arguments against, say, homosexuality is no longer nature, because the other side, the side that wants to have that life, no longer accepts that as a valid way to argue about that topic. They will ignore the argument that certain things are natural. They simply have discarded that off the table.
And of course, our mutual friend Bob Riley has just published a great book about that. We had him here on the show a few weeks ago from Ignatius Press. Where he really does a very great job in philosophically destroying that argument that individuals are free simply to declare themselves free of any natural demand or even having a nature of any kind.
Exactly. And you look at the American founders. One of the thinkers the American founders relied upon was the English philosopher John Locke. And while John Locke and others were not big on using religious reasons for doing things, they did in fact make a recognition that even if you're not a person of faith, whether you like it or not, you still are a product of nature's God. And so you will always have that obligation. That does not go away simply because you have decided you don't believe certain things.
Now,
in other words, you don't become an entity unto yourself. We are all entities unto God.
Now, I'm gonna really throw at you the hardest question of all, Jeff. Dr. Jeff Martineau, you're Catholic. You're raised Catholic. And you believe in basic Catholic Orthodox view of things. Our church, beginning with the great social encyclicals of Leo XIII back in the 1880s and 90s to the present, has largely adopted this modern concept of rights as entitlements. I think I'm right about that. In other words, if a person has a human right, and again, they're calling it a human right, not a natural right, then if a person lacks it, say, let's call it health care, then it should be supplied by the state.
Yes.
I think I'm right in stating the church's position. Am I not?
Yes, and I want to be careful. I don't want to come across that I'm going to criticize.
Well, no, I should be careful because I'm the one pushing the question. I mean,
well, you know,
I don't want to sound heartless because I think people are deserving of health care, but I don't think I would couch it in terms of it being a human right.
Yes, no, I think it de facto cannot be. I mean, one might say you have a right, you know. It depends on what one means by a right to life. You know, if we think of life in the context of the Declaration, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. You know, I think what philosophers have always meant by life is that you have, God gives you the ability, the right to protect yourself and to do the things that are needed for your preservation. That's not to say that somehow that obligates others to be able to do things to also preserve your health. Now, you could throw in things like the social contract, and do you then, by having a social contract, where people agree to come together to form communities, where does health fit into that? I still don't think you get to the point of it being a natural or a human right to it. I think the mistake that too many... I'll just say priests. I think often too many times priests, they are somewhat lacking perhaps in their own education. It's just like the rest of society, we ought not to be surprised that we, even within the clergy, they're not always educated as well as they could be. And that, again, I'm not knocking priests. I'm just saying that it's whatever ill society has, that's...
Look, we're all here on the phone trying to figure out rights, and you and I both have doctorates in philosophy, and we're trying to figure it out. So it's inherently confusing.
Well, it is. I think that, as you know, there's been an awful lot of Marxist thought that's gotten into the education of the clergy in the 20th and 21st century. And I think for many of these, particularly when they're young, and particularly when they see poverty, and when they see potentially terrible things in other parts of the world, and then they see some places that are very well off, they might come to that kind of a conclusion.
And see it in terms of rights.
Yes.
It's one thing to see it in equality and want to address it, but it's quite another thing to say we're going to address it because these people with less resources have right to more resources. Is that a good line of thinking?
I think it is. And, you know, if I were to look at it, if I were to look at the church as a whole, you know, it's interesting that in a certain sense, you know, when it comes to the life of the unborn, the church is very clear and has stayed very clear on that point. But that's interesting because that view of the unborn really goes back to what we've been talking about, the principle that of what America was founded on. But on these other issues, it's almost as if there's a split that's occurred. And that there's a different philosophy thought about for everything else.
So we're operating in a world of parallel philosophies, but contradictory philosophies?
Yeah, it could be. And again, I don't think they realize it. Again, I don't think they all had good philosophy or good political philosophy professors and courses.
But look, I'm going to say that I would say the majority of Catholics live sort of with the same confusion that we're talking about. In other words, they know both from their Catholic teaching and from their understanding of the United States Declaration of Independence that there are such things as rights that come to us from the Creator and cannot be taken away. They all get that.
Yes.
But then they hear rights to health care, rights to housing, rights to immigration, rights to this, rights to that. And they may feel down deep some sort of confusion between what these other rights are and what health, immigration, home, you know, a home, private home, and so forth. And they just sort of shrug their shoulders. Well, they must be unalienable rights just like the pursuit of happiness. They must be in that same big category of human rights.
Yeah, I think you're right, Deal, and I think that it's a question much larger than the amount of time that we have to talk about it. But you know, I think I would pinpoint why we have that split, and I think the reason we have that split is because in the West, and I don't mean the Western United States, but I mean in the Western world, which was largely the Christian world. But over time, so you know, largely Europe, the United States, so the UK and the Dominions and so forth, you know, it used to be that we could defend what we stood for, what we believed as the foundations for our society. We were, you know, you go back to the 1860s with Lincoln. Lincoln wonderfully articulates the American principles of the founding and why those are eternal and how he's so successful in talking about why slavery is simply a man-made entity. It's not a natural condition. But, you know, we've lost some of that over time. We are no longer in the West collectively able to defend what we think is our way of life or why we ought to have a certain way of life. We have been convinced that what we want and what we like is really just, it's just our preference, or it's just luck, where you happen to be born in a certain place and whatnot. And there's no question luck. There's always a certain amount of luck in things.
Then why do we get outraged at slaughters in Africa? Why do we get outraged at 200 young girls are kidnapped in Nigeria? I mean, what's the source of this outrage if we don't have moral norms anymore? We must have.
Well, I think that the average person does have, for the most part. But see, we have not been talking about it, Deal, at the personal or the individual mm-hmm. level. We've been talking about it at the collective or the state level. And those are two different things. In other words, an individual can commit a sin, it can feel remorse, it can feel happiness, but can you say those same things at a macro level? And that's a deeper question. And so what we have is individuals can feel pain, they can feel sympathy, they can be outraged, they can be concerned. But then you have a state entity that has to then make decisions and has to do things. And if you think about these Nigerian girls that have been kidnapped, you know, what's going to prevent that from happening? Well, what's going to prevent that from happening is people being put on the ground that are going to go and do something with the guys that did this and going to go get those girls back. Well, that's a collective, that's a state decision. Those are not individual decisions. So I think we have to make a distinction that many individuals can think quite correctly and they can have the right views within their own lives. But
let me read for you one short paragraph from the Catechism of the Catholic Church on human rights. It's in paragraph 1930. And it's short. Let me just read it to you. It says, "Respect for the human persons entails respect for the rights that flow from his dignity as a creature. These rights are prior to society and must be recognized by it. They are the basis of the moral legitimacy of every authority. By flouting them or refusing to recognize them in its positive legislation, a society undermines its own moral legitimacy. If it does not respect them, authority can rely only on force or violence to obtain obedience from its subject. It is the Church's role to remind men of goodwill of these rights and to distinguish them from unwarranted or false claims." So how would you place that statement in the context of our discussion?
Well, you notice that they talk about positive.
I know. They drop that. In other words, it sounds like the old view of human nature that we were talking about that's embodied in the founding our American founding documents, right?
It seems like they're at a certain, what they're saying, and I'd have to think about that statement much more than we have time for, but it seems to me that the statement is saying is that we have governments, you know, that God has put in place on earth government. And part of what the government is to attempt to achieve is some semblance of what we might call justice. And the way of doing that is going to have to be through positive enactments of legislation or creation.
But based upon rights that are all unalienable and
yeah.
belong to the human person by virtue of the person's created dignity. So it's a combination of the old and the new.
Yes, I think the problem is that few people understand that every desire, every want does not qualify as an unalienable right.
Like you say, as you pointed out, as I read that, you pointed out rightly, the one, for lack of a better term, progressive or modernist phrase in it, to recognize them in its positive legislation. In other words, recognize the rights of the human person in its positive legislation.
Yeah.
That is, okay, now that, by the way, would have been true of what is implied by the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, right?
Yes, that to a certain extent, you know, our nature needs to be reflected in our government. In other words, if you take the way I would think about that is that the U.S. Constitution is a document written with the founders' understanding of our human nature in mind. The Federalist Papers talks about that this form of government comports with the, quote, genius of the American people. In other words, what they were saying is that if the founders had really thought, well, really the best form of government really would be a monarchy, they were basically saying, even if we thought that was best, the American people wouldn't tolerate us establishing a monarchy. Because the genius of the American people is that they need to govern themselves. And so in light of governing themselves, this is the form of government. This is, we think, the best form of government in light of our human nature. And I think, unfortunately, in the large part, we don't think of what human nature is. We seem to think that it changes over time, or that it can be made into something else, or that, in fact, we can ignore it. You know, if you think of the situation with Ukraine recently and the interaction with the leader of Russia, Putin, there was a lot of discussion, a lot of back and forth in various essays about not properly understanding human nature. And that by not properly understanding human nature, the West has engaged with him in ways that don't register. And I think, you know, there's something to that, particularly for progressives. You have to recognize that for progressives, they view human nature as different. They view it as, if you can simply, they're very Platonic. I want to talk about what people's heads, but the philosopher Plato basically argued that if you get something wrong, if you make a mistake in your life, the only reason you made that mistake is not because you're an evil person or because you had evil intent, it's because you were not properly formed or educated. So for progressives, they would argue that all we have to do is keep beating the drum, educate people the proper way, tell them what is right, and eventually we'll get it right.
I think what's interesting in all this is that the Catechism talks about positive legislation, but doesn't require positive legislation to go to the level of specificity and detail that we now see it going to. Because positive legislation is fine as long as it reflects a view of human nature that is true, not one that's been invented by the state in order to create vast dependencies.
Yes.
And so
even then, I would say that I think the church would not cut it quite that finely. I think that the church would say, in certain instances, it's fine, even if we're looking at it the wrong way, as long as certain enactments take place, we'll accept that. If an entity is willing to say we're going to have universal health care, the good from that outweighs the negative, and so therefore we will accept it. And my point going back to the beginning, this is the way I always think about it whenever I teach courses with students, is that keep in mind, you may have won today. Let's say that you were on that side of the issue and you have just essentially won on that argument. Keep in mind that what you're doing by not basing what your view of people in human nature, not basing the government based on human nature, you run the risk that at some point another group, another set of people in the future is going to come back and say, you know what, that no longer applies. And we see that all the time. We see that with property rights. We have a very different view of property rights now than we used to. And in some cases, the state has been able to take away people's rights, of people's property, whereas the founders would have said that that's a fundamental no-no. You can't do that. So you can see that over time, as different arguments are put forth and as supposedly the needs change, if you're going to base it on, say, tradition, or if you're going to base it on a different view of human nature and a different view of happiness, or if you're going to be utilitarian about it and say, we need to say we have to have X tax dollars, we need to achieve certain things, just realize that you as a person are not really being fundamentally protected. You run the risk, or your descendants run the risk later on of being viewed differently by another set of people.
I've been talking with Dr. Jeff Martineau about the concept of right, natural right, human right, positive rights, or rights concedes that positive rights is considered something the state determines and then fulfills their obligation toward its citizens to provide the goods that those rights are trying to obtain, for example, health care or housing. And I think that we can see that there's a lot more to talk about here, because our ultimate aim is to understand two things. One, the difference between the kind of concept of human nature, happiness, and natural rights that this country was based upon, and then the kind of understanding of human rights, human nature, happiness that the church would have us witness to and represent. And Dr. Martineau, will you come back and talk about that later, future time?
Oh, I'd be very happy to come back and talk with you again, Neil.
As we close, I want to thank each of you for listening. I hope you found it as enjoyable as I have in bringing it to you. Join me again next week on Church and Culture, brought to you by Ave Maria Radio.
If you have any comments or questions about Church and Culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.